It's the New Books Network Podcast.
Hi, it's Alan Salkin of New Books in Food. This week, this episode, we're interviewing Laura Silver, the author of Knish, In Search of the Jewish Soul Food. It all started when her beloved Knish shop disappeared and she went on search for the roots of the humble Jewish pastry. It also, like a lot of great food books, involves good food and memoir and family history and what the food means to her. And there's a little song, a little dance, a little pie, a little seltzer in your eye. I think that's from Mary Tyler Moore. But anyway, welcome to New Books in Food, Laura Silver.
It's great to be here.
And so the book's from Brandeis University Press. It comes out May 6, 2014. It's part of a series on Jewish women. So tell us first of all, tell us, what is a knish?
A knish, as you may or may not know, is a wrapped pastry. I like to think of it as a pillow of mashed potatoes surrounded by a skin of dough. Now, a knish can take a lot of forms, and it can have a lot of fillings. It can be round or square. Knish can be oval. It can be filled with savory filling or sweet. The most popular knish is undeniably potato with onions, an onion-strewn potato, mashed potato innard. And the other kinds are kasha, which is buckwheat. You can also have knishes with a sweet cheese. But beyond the specifications of the knish is what it really represents. And this pastry, like an empanada or a samosa, is a repository for filling, but it's also a repository for stories and memories.
And, well, what are yours?
Well, mine, as you mentioned, did begin with Mrs. Stahl's, which was a knish shop in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. It opened in the 30s. But my family had been going there probably, I'm not sure when it started, but my grandparents had certainly been going there for several decades. And my dad after them. And so when I was a kid, my family, which lived in Queens, would travel for about an hour just to get to Mrs. Stahl's. And it was like a pilgrimage site for us. That's how it began.
Now, I remember Mrs. Stahl's. It was sort of under the tracks or where the subway kind of turns near Coney Island or Brighton Beach. And as I remember, it used to be its own store. And then at some point, it sort of split in half and they were selling like burritos and hot dogs on one side. And I mean, in a way, it's like the story of the Jewish diaspora, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it did. Mrs. Stahl's did. It was under the subway at Brighton Beach Avenue and Coney Island Avenue. And that exactly where the subway turns. And yes, it did take at some point in, I think, the late 90s, the store did take on what I call a roommate. It was a shared space with more like a souvlaki kind of place. The place had its name in Russian, but it translates to Eastern feast. Mm. And there was meat on a skewer and a lot of appetizers. And so the store was pretty much literally split down the middle. And one half on the right had this telltale waist height orange formica counter,
right,
the length,
yeah,
of the store. And then all these signs in the back, these huge dangling signs with knish prices, which had been taped over with newer prices, and you know, every variety of knish imaginable, mushroom potato, spinach, vegetable, kasha, potato, sweet, cherry cheese, blueberry cheese. And then on the left were these like serving table, were at a little higher up.
Is it possible? And this is, I mean, we'll get more into the story of why you got so involved and interested in this. And where it took you overseas and all around the world. You went in search of the knish. But I was having lunch yesterday with Mark Russ Fetterman, who runs, obviously, Russ and Daughters, the legendary smoked fish emporium on the Lower East Side. And Mark and I both have books that came out last year. Mine's about the Food Network, and his was about the history of that amazing store that's one of the few Jewish remnants of Jewish culture on the Lower East Side and still attracts a huge amount of people, all kinds of people, all kinds of religions and colors. And what Mark said to me was, Well, I was complaining that the Knish store on the corner here on the Lower East Side, which is Yonah Schimmel, is terrible. That the Knishes don't taste good. The place is a wreck. And tourists love to photograph it because it's so unchanged, but it's unchanged from being bad. And what Mark said was, well, it's always been bad. And so, you know, I'm going to get to a question here, by the way. I remember Mrs. Stahl's as being good.
And yes, I can't disagree.
Right. And so the question is the reason that you potentially fell in love with it because you happened upon a good Knish, and is the Knish good?
Yes. The Knish is inherently...
I want to add one more thing. Because what Mark said, well, this was just peasant food. It was just supposed to be this big, heavy lump of stuff to fill your belly. I'm not attacking. I'm just wanting to hear a defense. Are you defending something that was simply just, you know, the cheapest thing that peasants could use to fill their bellies as something that is deserving of something that maybe it's really best left in the past?
Well, you know, that's not the first time I've heard this argument. The Knish is undeniably a humble food. And it's nothing too fancy about it in most cases. The writer Vivian Gornick said to me, why? Why do you want to talk about the Knish? Like, what's so great about it? What's so great about the past? Sort of like people flock to the Lower East Side today. They really romanticize a past that was so difficult and ugly and grim and that no one would really want to live in. But the thing is, the Knish has survived, and I think it deserves credit for that. Mm. It's an underdog of foods. I think once you start examining an underdog of foods, it leads you to led me to some really fascinating stories of people who've been all but forgotten in history. And I think, you know, the sentiment you express that there's no good Knish there is pretty common. People love to complain about Knishes or the lack thereof. Oh yeah, that's a very popular refrain. You can't get a good Knish anymore. Yeah, what are they complaining about? I mean, they're complaining in a way about their success. Why can't you get a good Knish? Because there are very few blue collar Jewish neighborhoods. Everyone who lived in those neighborhoods when you could get a good Knish were people who had it tough. It was rough. That's what sustained the Knish, you know, Jewish neighborhoods where people were really struggling to make a living. Like, you can get a lot of good dumplings in New York now, cheap food. Now it's like Chinese food, things like that.
That's true.
So I think people, it is a bit of romanticizing the past, but I still think there's something there and that the trajectory of the Knish charts this amazing history of individuals. And in some cases, people we'd rather forget or people we just like to romanticize without thinking of the real situations of their lives and how those situations led to our prosperity, in fact.
When did the romanticizing of the Knish begin? I mean, I see in your book, you've got songs, you've got, there's even a note about the first Knish movie appearance.
Yeah, well... The Knish first appeared, the first filmic documentation I was able to find was in a movie called The Night They Raided Minsky's. And that is, that film also even, I think it was made in the late 60s. And then, even then it was sort of reflecting on the Lower East Side with this nostalgia. And I think it relates to when it was safe to go back to these memories. You know, when it was just far enough away to be filled with nostalgia instead of close to pain. And in fact, when it's started, now that you can't get a good Knish, everyone wants one. But what the last owner of Mrs. Stahl's, Les Green, said to me was, you know, everyone said you can't get a good Knish. But then they move to the suburbs and they come here once a year. How can I support my business with people coming here once a year?
Right. That's the Little Italy story. I mean, there was that book, The Land of Our Fathers, right? Wasn't that the sort of beginning of the romanticism? I can't remember who wrote it right now, but the beginning of romanticizing that Jewish ghetto life. What's his name?
Irving Howe.
Right. Irving Howe.
Yeah, that's definitely part of that movement, looking back. And I think now you also see a big resurgence of American Jews who'd like to visit Poland, visit the places where their families are from in Poland. And I think it's not unrelated. You know, enough time has passed, the political situation has changed, and people have enough money to be able to afford a trip like that for a vacation. And so they choose to come in contact.
What do they find? Because, you know, I always say that there was a mistake made about 15 years ago. I wrote an article for the Times about the vanishing Jewish Lower East Side, which, of course, was mostly vanished. But I went the last day that Ratner's, the dairy restaurant, was open. And, you know, the tenement museum down here attracts so many tourists. And, you know, I live in the Lower East Side, and there's tourists just wandering around with maps looking for the Jews and looking for heritage. And, you know, what they find is some smoked fish. They find an old tenement building. And if you look, you find the guy selling pickles and some great headstones. I think there was a real opportunity to create, just like in Little Italy, which really is just a theme park now, I think a great little theme park could have been created on the Lower East Side with some of the real old surviving businesses that now is just this real spotty thing. And I mean, is Poland doing better, or is there anything to find there?
Well, first of all, I'd say that I think the Lower East Side is a bit of a theme park in a way. I mean, I was at the closing of Ratner's too the last day, and the last day was too late. I mean, already it was sad in there, and I had a lot of memories of being in Ratner's, what's called a dairy restaurant.
The onion rolls were still good though up till the last day. Those were good rolls.
Well, yeah. I mean, I still look for onion rolls everywhere because that's, you know, another part of my heritage. But for people who don't know, Ratner's was this place on Delancey, and they had this huge marquee with its name and script letters. And you know, I enjoyed several Christmases there, and I'd bring non-Jewish friends there to sort of acculturate them to who I was. And the waiters were known for putting their fingers in soup and being brusque.
Yeah.
You could probably still find some brusque waiters on the Lower East Side, but I worked also at the Tenement Museum, actually, and I encountered many people coming looking for their past, including a descendant of the Ratner's family. Mm. But the thing is, now you find a lot of people would come and say, oh, my kids live down here, so how much do we want to preserve it? And again, I caution against nostalgia. I mean, we just saw this big story in the Times about Speaker Sheldon Silver, who prevented the development of an apartment of this real estate because he wanted to keep the Jewish character of the neighborhood. I mean, at what cost? I think that's an uncomfortable fact for us to think about. You know, what is there? People, there. It is a theme park. There is the pickle guy. There's Kosar's.
What Shelley Silver should have done, and there's a lot of things he should have done that he never did. But anyway, they should have created a clearer heritage area, to my eye, to satisfy that constituency while allowing more development and building less ugly crap down here. But you're right. And there is still stuff. There's Kosar's Bialy's. Although, interestingly, the kosher deli that opened recently, that closed.
Yeah, Noah's Ark. I know they were on record for making the largest matzo ball in history. And it was actually made in New Jersey, and they brought it back to New York. But, yeah, I was sad to see that because it was actually kosher, like closed on Saturday kosher, which Kosar's is not. And there is the Jewish character of the Lower East Side that's preserved. People just don't like that Jewish character because it's an Orthodox Jewish character, and that doesn't fit in with people's memories. So, say, if you really want to think about what Jewish past and Jewish future is, or any ethnic past or New York past and New York future, it's important to be somewhat flexible about the aperture of that lens.
Let's talk about the Knish again for a second.
Okay.
What do you think does make a good Knish? And is there a recipe? Is it something that one can make oneself?
Yes, and actually that's what I advise. You know, when people say, I can't get a good Knish, I say, well, why don't you make one yourself? You know, where do you get the best one? And I say, well, look, I can tell you some places, but the best Knish is one you make yourself. And why? Because it's homemade. And I think, and it's a lot of work. I won't joke. I once made 100 on my own in my kitchen, and that took the better part of a day, including, you know, not including the prep beforehand. But My book does have a recipe. It's the Mrs. Stahl's recipe for potato knishes. I got it from her granddaughters. And they taught me. I was also lucky enough to visit with them. One lives on the Upper West Side of New York, the other in San Francisco. And when I located them, Toby, the granddaughter on the West Coast, invited me out. We had a knish baking session and party. And there are a few keys. I mean, you have to work really. She said, you need a family. Like, you need a small family to make some knishes. The dough has to be rolled out till it's really paper thin, till you could read the newspaper through it. And I think you just need to keep at it. You know, a lot of people, you need a lot of people, or if you're doing it yourself, a lot of time.
So you need to make a dough and a filling.
Exactly, a dough and a filling. We made the potato filling with onions, and that's the one you'll find in the book. We also made a kasha filling and another one, a sweet knish, cherries, knish with like cheese, sweet cheese and cherries. And we went on a trip to the Russian area of San Francisco, then the Richmond, and we went to get the provisions there. So that was like a little odyssey in itself.
Yeah, especially since they don't have proper stop signs at every intersection over there in the Richmond. So this took you to San Francisco, the book. It took you to, where else did you have to travel?
Well, a few times, of course, to the Brooklyn Boardwalk and around the Lower East Side. But more notably, I went to France because I heard this rumor that the first knish may have been from France. And I did study abroad a bit in France in college, so I knew the language and had some friends there. I found a knish at in the Marais, which is the Jewish quarter or really a street. And mostly it's filled with falafel places because it's much more Sephardic with Jews from Spain. Spanish heritage, and a place called the Yellow Boutique still had knishes. They're triangular in shape, and they were kind of like brioches, the consistency of a brioche. So, but they were very yellow, and somehow that was shocking and reassuring all at once. I also went to Israel. It seems like an obvious place to search for knishes because if it's the Jewish homeland, surely there would be some manifestation of this Jewish food that meant so much to me. And I found a knish-like food at a place called Cafe Batya, which is almost like the Second Avenue Deli of Tel Aviv. It's a place that predates Israeli statehood. It's been around since the early 40s. And Batya, the namesake, Batya is still alive. She's in her 90s. And the knish there was rather odd, though. It was like a ball of mashed potatoes with breadcrumbs on the outside and fried. The center was some meat, but hey, if they called it a knish, I was happy to give it a try. In Hebrew, it's called a leviva memulet, which means like a fried latke or a potato pancake.
Now, see, given a choice between a latke and a knish, I take a latke every time.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that. I feel like you might need to improve your knish.
Well, I'm going to try making them. I am going to try.
I think it's really satisfying. And I will say that I taught a class called Knish History 101 at the Brooklyn Brainery. And one of my star pupils, Noah Wildman, started his own Knish business. He's also on the Lower East Side. And his place is called Knishery NYC. His Knishes are sold on East Broadway at a place called Malt and Mold. Yes. So I'm happy to say I helped spawn, some kind of knish renaissance for starters.
Hipster knishes.
Hipster. He's, quasi-hipster. But to go back to the question about where the knish took me, I'd say the most important place was probably Poland. And first, I'd been to Poland earlier always out of curiosity for family roots. When I was studying in France, actually, I had a chance to go to Poland. But I didn't see any of the places my people were from or the places I thought they were from. However, in 2008, I went on a roots trip with some of my extended family members. And yeah, we are those people who, feel like it's safe, quote unquote, to go to Poland. And we were in the town of Bialystok, which is in the west, about 2 hours from Warsaw. And we couldn't find a lot of remnants of our family, no proof, really. And Bialystok is a city that was once 90% Jewish. Like all the stores in the town square were owned by Jews. Yiddish was the lingua franca. So this was...
Bialystok is the name of, and the producers, right? That's the name of
Bialystok. Yeah, and people think of it as a joke, but in fact, I mean, there's a reason for that. You know, people identify with that name as Polish because, I mean, if you ask, you know, in Jews of Ashkenazi or Eastern European descent in New York today, I'd say 1 in 10 would have some connection to Bialystok. That's how prominent a city it was in the Jewish, in Jewish life and in Jewish memory. So our last day of the trip, and we were a little disappointed and kind of eager to get out of there, but my cousin had this birth certificate from her mom, and it said, we showed it to our Polish tour guide who read it and said, oh, she's not, she wasn't born in Bialystok. She was born in a small town about 20 minutes from here. What was the town called? Knishin.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
So that, at that moment, I begged my family, and these are, we're like six people who rarely see each other. We can only meet in Poland, even though some of them live in New Jersey. We come together in Poland for this massive trip. I said, please, let's go there now. You know, like, we have to go. This is our destiny. And Knishin, I'd read in the guidebook, had once had a Jewish population, and it had a woman who lived there who remembered the Jews. And I thought, you know, we must go. It also was home to this cemetery, a Jewish cemetery that still existed because it was built around the pools of a royal castle. So it wasn't destroyed by the Nazis. It was a logistical mess, so it wasn't destroyed. Anyway, long story short, the next year I went back to Knishin on my own.
Oh, they didn't go?
No, we didn't go. It was
too
late.
Those bastards.
Hey!
Come on!
The tour guide had to work the next day.
So you had to go back the next year. Okay, go on. You went back.
It was nightfall. Yeah, I went. Don't talk about my family like that. Hey, you know, people, they've done a lot of traveling.
I accept that. Okay. I apologize and I take it back.
Thanks. But yeah, the feelings run deep. It's true. And I went back the next year and there I was. In the town of Knishin, a population 2,000 plus. And I met the town historian who came over on his bike.
Now, he wasn't wrapped up in a thin layer of dough, right? He was just a man, a person.
Right, yes. These are real people.
Okay. They're not made of potato on the inside. Okay, go on.
No. I didn't see any broken skin when I was there.
Right.
First, we met with the town, so the PR guy. And he, you know, I thought I was joking around. I arrived with these photos of Knishes because I was sort of looking for any relative would be almost ridiculous. But he hadn't seen these Knishes before, but he did know about a legend related to the Knish. And there are two, actually. One says the Knish, that Knishin takes its name from this pastry.
Ah.
And the other said that there were, at times, at funerals, weepers, or these women paid to cry at funerals, would hand out wrapped pastries or knisha to mourners to comfort them in their grief. And that was really interesting to me because round foods are typically used in Jewish mourning rituals. Mm-hmm. And it was also about loss. And it seemed like an interesting correlation to the average New Yorker's, you know, battle cry of, I can't get a good knish anywhere. So that was an interesting link. And those funerals I was talking about weren't Jewish funerals. They were Christian funerals. So this started to wonder if the Knish could indeed be the ultimate food for conversations about coexistence, some kind of catalyst for healing. And I'd say for me, it has been a bit. You know, I went back to Knishin just last summer.
Well, did you find any family members there or anybody who remembered anybody? Obviously not, but I mean... Anybody who remembered anything?
Well, that woman I had read about had died.
Mm-hmm.
She was a woman who remembered the Jews. There is a small house museum which she used to own. And the town historian showed me the names of some Jewish residents who had been members of the city council. And that was on this plaque was on the back of the church in town.
Mm-hmm.
But so I didn't expect to find anyone, but I did find out later in the archives that my mother's mom was also born in Knishin. So I am, in fact, a direct descendant of the Knish.
Unbelievable. But the best theory that you have is that the town takes its name from the pastry rather than the pastry having been born there.
Well, yeah, that's what the legend says, that the king was passing through and was served these pastries on horseradish leaves. And the king said, oh, he gave one of the women, the bakers, a gold coin. She clutched it to her chest. And the king said, you know, what do you call these pastries, my lady? She said, Knish, Knish, sire, Knish. He said, and what do you call this town? She said, it's a forest hamlet. And he said, from now on, it shall be called Knishin.
Oh, so it is possible that the... Oh, do you know where they came from?
The first Knish?
Yes.
Well, I'd say it is from that area of, you know, the Pale of Settlement and more in the western area, like a little more to... I mean, let's see. Actually, more eastern Poland. I'd say more eastern Poland, near where Bialystok is today, and then eastward from there. Like, I have evidence in parts of Ukraine, even Belarus, and that whole swath of land.
Had anyone ever studied the Knish before?
Good question. There had definitely been references.
Finally.
Go
ahead, yeah.
They were all good questions.
All right.
I did start out by looking at references to Knishes in PhD theses,
right,
things like that. But those were pretty localized, like based on New York food, chapters about New York food. There were some reports in Yiddish and Yiddish journals I found in YIVO, and that, like, it was oral history based on, you know, how to make baked goods. But again, the Knish was just one of several pastries mentioned. There's a book written in, a kid's poem, rather, written in Yiddish about the Knish that came from Vilna or Vilnius, Lithuania in the 1920s. But in terms of really deep research, you know, it wasn't even listed in Encyclopedia Judaica. Mm. And that was kind of a blow. But that just...
Why is that a blow?
Why is it a blow? Because I felt like I think of it as a quintessential Jewish food. And here the master work didn't even give it a nod.
I mean, here we have, so you're, in a way, you found your own roots by chasing the Knish, which you did not expect to find.
No, but I will say that I was very interested in genealogy before. I'd written about some other quote-unquote lost family members for the Times, people killed in an apartment fire on Mermaid Avenue. I had been looking in microfilm for ages in trying to find my family roots on all sides. So it was nothing new, but I had, you know, given up the trail or just stopped looking or, you know, lost interest for a while. And I had research, you know, in the 1970s, my Nana, who was the one who was born in Knishin, she wanted to go visit her cousin in Israel. And she needed a passport, which meant she needed citizenship, which meant she needed a birth certificate from Poland. And my mom wrote to the Polish government, and they said, nope, we don't have it. Nah, not her, not born here. And now I know why. She had a totally different name when she was born. You know, it just shows how many secrets there are. And I was able to come up with this name thanks to this very expert genealogist, Yael Reiser, who was working in Warsaw. And he helped me look up some records and realize that, you know, my family's last name was Chapnik and not Levy, which is something my cousin told me, but I didn't quite believe. So, yeah, the Knish really led me to the truth, to the past, my family's past.
What? I mean, and of course, in the classic, in Roots, the thing that started so many people on, you know, that 1970s television series based on the book by Alex Haley about tracing his African roots, you know, he knew two words of African. I believe that was the sort of thing that allowed him, or of the language, not African, of the language from the place where his descendants were from, and that's what sort of allowed him to trace the whole story back. And so for you, it ultimately was this lump of potatoes surrounded by dough.
Yeah, I'd say it was the catalyst for further exploration and in wanting to know really what my connection to the Knish was, why it mattered so much, and why its disappearance irked me so much, what was behind it, what that meant to be something from the quote-unquote old country.
Well, so you almost had this personal identification with the Knish. You saw some of yourself in the Knish.
I guess you could put it that way. Yeah, what happened is my grandmother, at the end of her life, moved to the senior housing place in Brighton Beach. So she was very close to Mrs. Stalls, and that every visit to her was a visit to Mrs. Stalls, and vice versa. So there was no such thing as visiting my grandmother without bringing Knishes. And when my grandmother passed away, I still clung to Mrs. Stalls as this kind of gateway to memories of her and a way to conjure her. So, yeah, I felt very closely allied with the Knish.
So what happened? Tell me the story of the day you showed up and it was gone.
Well, so it was a November day in, I'd say, 2005. And I had been, you know, my visits to Brighton Beach were fewer and fewer, but I still went there every so often. And I biked down to the beach, like a half hour bike ride from my house. And I get there, and this is how to mark arrival at the beach, buying a Knish. I did that. I park my bike and I see all these flags, like these sort of grand opening kind of flags in front of the store. And I realize, and as you said, the shop was for 70 years beneath the elevated subway. But when I arrived that day, I saw that it had become, in fact, a Subway sandwich shop. Yep. So I was flabbergasted. I mean, what could I do? I sort of walked around. I went in. I mean, I asked a few questions, but I was really kind of shell-shocked, and I just left. I looked for some other snack, and I went to the beach. What could I do? But that's what spurred research. I called around, and I spoke to Mike Conti, ultimately, who was the owner of Conti's Pasta in New Jersey, in Vineland, New Jersey, which is a town historically known for Jewish chicken farmers. But he owns a pasta factory, and he had purchased the Knish recipe. So the Knish was in exile, but I felt like it was in good hands, and that he was still shipping the Knishes back to New York. So I followed the trail. And
under the brand of Mrs. Stalls?
Yeah, and they were supposed to come with these little signs that said Mrs. Stalls, but I never saw them with the signs. And they were being sold at places like Murray's Bagel Shop and so forth. Mm. In bagel shops and, you know, in New York City, in the five boroughs. I did more recently speak to Steve Tufo, who was a distributor for Mrs. Stalls and still is. I mean, he's a distributor for Conti's too. And he said the amounts of Knishes declined, the orders declined, and there's a different kind of different process for making foods now, making these Knishes, and they're delivered par baked often. Mm-hmm. So they're not really baked on site; they're more like warmed up on site. So things have evolved. It's a different people don't have a need to make all these foods in their own shop. It's no longer cost effective. In many cases.
So they're still making Mrs. Stahl's Knishes, but it's changed a bit. You can still get that Knish.
You can, technically, although...
You don't like it. You don't think it's any good?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'd say it's not the same as the Knish Mrs. Stahl's granddaughters make. And there is a guy in Florida who was interested in starting up a Knish factory under the Mrs. Stahl's name, and he even was looking into buying it from... He had an option to purchase the Stahl's recipe from Mike Conti. I haven't heard back yet. I haven't heard from him recently, but he's in the book too. So it just shows there. And he started a Facebook page for Mrs. Stahl's Knishes, and there are more than 2,000 likes.
But I think you're right. I think the moment of what it was and now what it is just this nostalgia thing that's not going to be, you know, for the peasantry to fill their bellies at a low cost. I mean, is that in fact what it was?
Well, that's, you know, historically, yeah, push carts on the Lower East Side. People would grab a Knish for lunch.
What's the proper way to eat it?
With mustard.
You cut it open or?
You put the mustard. I mean, depends on where you are, right? I mean, and what kind of Knish you have. I would really advise with mustard. But that I met these women in Minnesota who don't eat it, who would never think to eat it with mustard. I mean, that's a regionalism, I think.
Would they stick a bratwurst in it? I mean.
No bra. I mean, I guess you could. I'm not into that. I like to preserve, you know, at least.
All right, now, we've been avoiding something here, though.
What's that?
What is that travesty that is sold on hot dog carts in New York that's called a knish? What is that thing?
I wouldn't, you know, those are fighting words, Alan. That, I think you're talking about the square, yellow, fried Coney Island knish, which is the Gabilla's knish. And we're not too far away from the knish crisis of 2013, which began right on the cusp of Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, or Thanksgivica, and lasted till almost Passover in 2014, so about 5 months. And there was public outcry. I mean, this story went out on the AP Wire.
I don't know the story. Explain it to me. What are you talking about?
I don't know the story. There was a knish crisis. There was a factory. There was a fire at the Gabilla's factory, which is now in Copaig, Long Island. The factory actually got its start on the Lower East Side on Forsyth Street, and it moved to Williamsburg in the 20s. It was there till 2006, right after Mrs. Stalls went into exile. Gabilla's also went into exile, in my opinion, in Copaig on Long Island. But there was a factory in their fire. There was a fire in their factory, rather, and the machinery was out of commission. So for a number of months, there were no square knishes to be had, not at Katz's Deli, really not anywhere. You know, occasionally someone would find a box at a Wegmans somewhere in the South, but some woman auctioned some off on eBay. It was a tough time.
So you're saying every knish, every one of those square knishes is from the same place?
Pretty much. Okay. I mean, Noah Wildman, who I mentioned, did make some square knishes. So did the Kosher Culinary Center in Brooklyn.
And now they're back? Or did the fact that
back in action.
Was there a demand? Did maybe some of the hot dog vendors realize they didn't need those knishes anymore?
No, there was great demand. I mean, there was also a small knish crisis in the 90s when then-Mayor Giuliani regulated he was putting harsh regulations on sidewalk vendors based on types of carts, machinery that had to be used to sell potato-based foods. So that was a tough time for Gabilla's too. And I think then we saw the knish population diminish on street carts. But they came back. They're back.
But you're also defending that. To me, that's not. So you think that's a good product? To me, is that even a knish? I mean,
definitely a knish. I mean, look, I grew up on round knishes, but I definitely see the merits of the square.
But it's not just the shape. It's that the Mrs. Stalls, the Yonah Schimmel knish that I know as a knish has a almost like a thin pizza-like dough around it, whereas that thing has this weird gummy hide. The square one's got that weird yellow gummy hide.
Well, it's potato on potato. But I'd say, who are we to say there can only be one kind of knish? I mean, there are different kinds of apples. There are different kinds of pears. There are even different kinds of watermelons. Why should the knish be restricted to
it? Some watermelons are sweet and good, and some, you know, taste like a hard sponge. And the Mrs. Stahl's knish, you know, that you described has onions, and it's got a body to it. The other one tastes like an extruded, you know, sauce.
Well, I think you're leading into one of the big issues I've found in the knishosphere, which is this allegiance to round versus square or square versus round. And I'd say it's one of those quintessential Jewish and Talmudic questions. So in that way, yet again, the knish epitomizes Jewish life.
I'm shocked that you're even defending that square thing.
I'm shocked that you're so vehement about it.
To me, that's not a knish. I have very little respect for it. I've had, I don't know. I mean, I guess I've had it at those exact times when I thought, what is going to fill my stomach for the least amount of money? And that's when I've had those things. There's also a lot of some kind of grease in there. All right. So what is, take us back. You said you made at the epilogue of your book starts in Vineland. Is this what you're talking about? That you went to find what was left of the Mrs. Stahl's legacy?
I was in contact. Yeah. I was in contact with Mike Conti, and I was trying yet again to organize a visit. I didn't make it there. I mean, that's one part of the pilgrimage I wasn't able to accomplish in person. But I think, you know, what's interesting with Conti's is they became, their big product became gluten-free pasta. Mm. So the knish is no longer so important to them. And it's not their cultural heritage. It was just another income stream that was pretty easy to adopt.
Do you think that this story could end with you being the one to purchase the rights to the Mrs. Dahl's knish?
You know, for a while I did think about making knishes. I went, there's this great food incubator place up in Harlem called Hot Bread Kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I was really impressed with all the work with women who have come from all different countries and learned to bake and make their native foods, which are sold at green markets. But I think I'm really more of the chronicler. I'm happy to be the world's leading knish expert.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I need to be the leading baker. I'd love to see someone take it over and bring it back. And I do think we're on the cusp of a knish renaissance because we're still in economic tough times. People look for cheap food that has meaning.
Well, you got the dollar, the rise of the dollar slice of pizza in New York, which I do not understand how it's economically possible.
Yeah, I just had one of those last night, actually. Yeah. But, you know, I was going to, there's a, right down the block, there's a $2.75 slice of pizza. And I think it's just different clientele. You know, so I think there's a lot there. And I don't think the knish is going anywhere. It has a long history and a lot of promise.
Do you have an estimate on how many knishes are being consumed yearly or worldwide or New York or something?
You know, there's not no reporting from like a national knish board.
Yeah.
Per se. But Gabilla's seems put out about, I think it's a few million a year.
Oh.
But I mean, and we have no way of knowing how many knishes people consume in their homes. And there are a few other leading knish concerns in many delis. I see many making more and more, and even Jewish festivals in Idaho will serve knishes.
Well, do you think, to what extent is the name sort of one of its keys? It's such a cute name, the knish.
Yes, well, thank you. I think so, too. It's important to note it's one syllable and that the K is pronounced. That's
knish. Say it.
Knish.
Okay.
That's one of the things that really sets the knish apart. It hasn't assimilated in that way. And Mel Brooks, I think, said that words that start with K are inherently funny.
Right.
So it has another thing going for it. It is. It's an outsider. And, you know, it can be a bummer to be an outsider, but there's also strength in that.
Well, you do identify with this little thing. So how long was it from when you realized that retail location was closing to when you took up your pen and started this project? What year was it that it closed, and when was the book deal made?
Well, 2005 is when I witnessed the Subway sandwich shop in the place of Mrs. Dahl's. I published some articles about it in the Brooklyn Paper and the Jerusalem Report, early 2006. And I think the book deal, I think, was 2011.
Was there resistance? Were there people who thought the world does not need a book on the knish? Am I saying with two syllables?
I won't hold. Don't worry
knish.
About it.
Knish.
Perfect. It sounds like a sneeze a little.
Knish.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bless you. No, I think several agents were really interested. This I got a grant from the Hadassah Brandeis Institute at Brandeis, and they really helped. You know, they were huge champions, invited me to speak to their board, pitched it to their press. And I think there was definite interest. I didn't find any. You know, one agent said there were maybe too many puns in the initial proposal.
Yeah.
But even he thought it had legs.
Are you going to do a book on Bialy's next, or as you're a chronicler, not a cook right now. So what's the next project?
Well, the book on Bialy's is done. Mimi Sheridan wrote that, and it's called The Bialy Eaters. And I am pleased to say we have the same tour guide. And though I don't believe she traces her roots to to Bialystok.
What do you mean so the same tour? Oh, the same tour guide in Poland.
Poland, yeah. So that was a great, you know, that I felt honored by that. Next up for me, I'm doing some research on the pomegranate. And I'm interested in going back to the source of some things. I mean, I was thinking recently about gefilte fish.
Right, because there's a shortage this year, famously A1 story, front page story of the New York Times.
Yeah, right, another shortage. So therefore, I can help defend the gefilte fish, perhaps.
And there was a lot written in that article that people were saying, you know, it's one of those things you have on the table but nobody actually likes.
Right. I mean, it's time to champion the gefilte. People love to hate that, too. And there's a great song about gefilte fish. I teach this class at the New School about Jewish food through song and film.
Can you sing it to us?
No, but I can give you the URL so your listeners can have a list.
What's the URL?
Well, I'll...
you'll put it on the thing. Okay.
Sure, yeah. So, but it's beautiful. Adrian, the late, great Adrian Cooper, may she rest in peace, it's a beautiful song about gefilte fish. And I found three movies about gefilte fish, so it may be time to look into that. I'm interested also in writing converting this legend of the Knish to a kid's story. Mm.
But, you know, it does bring up this question. You talk about gefilte fish. I hesitate because there are great Jewish foods, you know, that certainly things that I love. I mean, I like even, what do you call it? The hearty stew stuff.
Cholent.
I really like a nice stick to your ribs. That's like, you know, it's literally made of ribs and it sticks to your ribs. And I don't even know if there's ribs. There's almost anything in that. But is Jewish food, I know I started this off by asking, are knishes good? You know, it's not Italian food. It's not Greek food. Although, of course, you know, there's Jews in all those places or were.
Still are.
Yes.
Smattering here and there.
Is Jewish food need more defenders? I mean, is there, because it's like, and also this, I mean, this is a bigger question and we're almost out of time, but the, you know, the Jewish deli, which has become the definer of what is Jewish food, is not necessarily an accurate picture. It's just what one kind of Jewish food was. Is Jewish food good, I guess, is the question.
I don't like that question.
Well, it's not the Mediterranean diet, you know. You don't see...
Well, depends on what Jewish food you're talking about, because Jewish food is really anything. I mean,
right.
Joe Nathan had this book about a search for Jewish food in France. Claudia Roden has written about Jewish food all over the world.
I guess my question and what the point may be is, like, has it been... why is there this persistence of that one version of Jewish food being thought to be it when, in fact, there is so much out there?
Well, I think it's changing. And you asked if there need to be more defenders of Jewish food. I think there need to be fewer attackers of Jewish food. I went to this amazing Passover Seder this year with three different kinds of haroset and traditions from countries all over the world. You know, Afghani Jews bring the shank bone, like tease each other with the shank bone during the meal. Sephardi Jews whip each other with scallions. I mean, there's a lot more traditions. It's just that, especially in New York, Jews of tend to be of Eastern European descent. That's the majority, but that's not the whole story. And deli food isn't the whole story. I mean, you know, David Sachs's great book, Save the Deli,
looks at
those establishments. But I mean, we're a culture and a society in transition. Our greater society and also Jewish society is at a real crossroads. And I think for it to be vibrant, we have to embrace, you know, not just knishes, but what I call knishin cousins, like Jewish foods of other backgrounds, burekas, samosas, other foods and Jewish traditions, and accept the fact that Jewish food traditions are very wide-reaching and not limited to a single country or area of the world.
Well, I do think that shank, as a shank bone by the Mel Brooks standard, is a funny word, as like knish. And I thank you for giving us this great history. And if I come across as a attacker of the knish, I don't mean to. I am only an attacker of a certain one kind of knish that I don't like. I just wanted to hear the defense, given that the man who sells more smoked fish in New York than any other was sort of attacking them. But maybe that's just his shank bone to grind. So
we're going to go head to head, by the way. Fish versus Knish. Mark Fetterman and I are going to go head to head. Knish versus Fish.
I think this would be a great event. Certainly, yours would be the less expensive option because there you need to take out a loan before you go into Russ and Daughters sometimes. Although the fish that built that market, which was the schmaltz herring, you know, that it really was actually the if you look at his book, the forebears who started Russ and Daughters were really selling herring out of a barrel, and that was the cheapest protein that they could sell. And you know, with the schmaltz, which made it weighty. So that, and they still sell those herring there, and they're actually the most reasonably priced thing still that they have. So it is possible to go into Russ and Daughters and get walk out with something for a good price. Anyway, I know I'm winding it up. So I thank you so much for being with us. I wish you luck with the book and to listeners, keep tuning in and listening and downloading from New Books in Food. I'm going to be doing more interviews. Joanna Harkin's going to be doing more. We're adding more people on soon. And it's just going to be a feast of delicious podcasts. So until next time, I have no catchphrase.
Keep eating, keep reading.
All right, good. Bye.
Thanks.